So last week, as we were reading from Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and having a rich conversation around transiency and suffering and so forth, the climate, turning Suzuki Roshi's teachings around how when something's being forced upon you, we may be presented with a precious teaching in the process. And so I think Mel suggested climate change, I think, is a possible topic. I pondered this and thought I would attempt to talk about climate change, not just as an inconvenient truth, but as an opportunity for Zen practice. So it's not a talk that is a proposal for how to solve the climate crisis, per se, which I'm not qualified to present, but rather meant to stimulate reflection on how to practice in accord with reality. And I propose that it can be possible both for suffering to exist and within that very same suffering, there lies an opportunity for practice. This is practice opportunity was a frequently used phrase when I was at San Francisco Zen Center. And it basically means you're having a problem, and you know, and how do you bring your practice to it? Here's an opportunity to practice. Well, welcome. Yeah. To your teacher, I'm suffering. How are you practicing with that? So, and of course in Zen, there's a lot of paradox in our capacity to hold both and is an important. There can be utter devastation in the world and it presents us with an opportunity perhaps as well to meet that reality. Because it's an alarm that's telling us that something is out of whack. So as Buddhists, the very beginning, you know, the center of the Buddha's first teaching, turning the wheel of the Dharma, is the first noble truth, and the first one being suffering, the truth of suffering, or unsatisfactoriness, anxiety or existential distress, maybe other translations of the word dukkha. And so this first noble truth encourages us not to try to escape from our difficult experiences of ourselves in the world, but to embrace them as part of reality, which is what we're trying to wake up to, the way things are. Yeah. Attention to suffering is key for any appropriate response to emerge. Again, holding paradox, attention to liberation too, and to the ways we're not suffering is key as well. This is the third noble truth. So we need to be able to recognize both how we're suffering and what causes suffering, and how we're not suffering, and the supportive conditions for us to experience such absence. But as Buddhists, again, we start with suffering. And some reasons for this. If we fear that the mess we're in is too awful to look at, then we won't actually be able to cope with the distress it brings up. And so we need to build that capacity to be with what is in order to wake up to the realization, or rather in relation to the entirety of our experience and the world around us. And returning a bit to read teachers who have studied this, you know, and taught on this topic for decades, including Joanna Macy and Thich Nhat Hanh. So Joanna Macy, she's really challenging us to feel the pain of the world, to not turn away from it. She's adamant that not only will this help us to respond to the suffering of the world, but it can also help us to liberate us from a small sense of self, a sense of separate self, with this sense of self that is an illusion according to the Buddhist teachings. So she says that the very danger signals, this is a problem that we need to sort of counter. From the basis of a separate self, we have certain habitual responses that make sense from that false belief. The very danger signals that should rivet our attention, summon up the blood, and bond us in collective action tend to have the opposite effect. Make us want to pull down the blinds and busy ourselves with other things. Yeah, sounds familiar, or perhaps not. I think for myself, I'm returning to these teachings and remember reading them years ago and being enthusiastic and like, yes. And I could see as I sort of, I felt challenged last week to talk about this topic because I think I've fallen into that sense of hopelessness almost at times, a little much too often. So I took this up as a challenge to, well, as an opportunity to find inspiration. And maybe in some ways too, before I go on, just to say, like, I've given many talks as a Zen teacher, and in some ways, like the talk that you're preparing is never gets finished. It's just at some point it's time to give it, and you give it. But the teaching is turning, and so there's something never, you know, fully locks into place and is complete in that way. And this that feels especially true for this one somehow, as I'm really turning. This question of how to respond. To a heating world and the suffering of many people and species, extinction. Joanna goes on to say, no one is exempt from the pain of the world itself, experienced in each of us. We are not closed off from the world, but integral components of it, like cells in the larger body. When that body is traumatized, we sense that trauma too. That pain is the price of consciousness in a threatened and suffering world. It's not only natural, it's an absolutely necessary component of our collective healing. As in all organisms, pain has a purpose. It's a warning signal designed to trigger remedial action. The problem, therefore, lies not with our pain for the world, but in our repression of it. Our efforts to dodge or dull it surrender us to futility and block effective response. So what she's cautioning us not to do. Most of this is from her book Active Hope. I recommend. List some reasons why we try to avoid this kind of pain. One is just a lot of them have to do with fear. Fear of pain. And our culture points out, views pain as dysfunctional. We have pills to help with it, right? To allow ourselves to feel anguish for the world is not only painful, it's frightening. It appears to threaten our capacity to cope with everyday life. And in fact, what's actually appears threatening and what might be threatened is our sense of small, separate self. There's something, inconvenient truths are poking at that illusory shell. And the pain is helping us to wake up to the fact that we're not separate. This is fear of despair and fear of appearing morbid or causing distress. By voicing our suffering, so how others will perceive us if we express any distress. Or that expressing our distress will make us appear weak and emotional. This fear of guilt that, oh, the world is burning and I'm not doing enough, which is kind of get caught in the either. We feel the pain, but then we make a story about me. And this kind of points to this underlying a lot of this response, which I hinted at, is this belief in a separate self. Like from our sense of separate self, these, you know, avoidance strategies make sense. However, because we're not separate and we inter are with everything, they're not successful, right? Joanna points out that there's an individualistic bias within Western culture and which conditions us to think that we're separate from the world that we live in. And from that perspective, it's hard to honor the pain for the world, our pain for the world, if we believe that we're essentially separate from it. It's a lot easier to judge it as being dysfunctional, as an inappropriate response. And a tendency to assume that feelings of fear, anger, and despair about the world are merely a reflection of some inner personal conflict that needs to be resolved. And so we're tempted to discredit feelings of that comes really from solidarity with fellow beings, human and more than human. Also points to fear of powerlessness. I don't want to think about this because there's nothing I can do about it. And so when forces seem too vast to be beyond our control, we resist the painful information they contain. And sort of shrink the sphere of our intention to those areas which we believe we actually have some control over. And I think this is not just speaking about climate, but in general too. And there are political forces that want us to feel this way because it, you know, disempowers us and make us not engage and actually engage our power and the capacity we have to change things. Anyway, Joanna says that what we're afraid of is not really powerlessness so much, but the afraid that we might feel powerless if we sort of try and engage in some ways. So it's easier to not think about the climate or to think but not feel. However, any sort of repression such as these come with a heavy price. And that's to the extent that we shut out our pain, don't allow ourselves to feel it, we shut out other feelings as well. It's kind of the psychic numbing. It says the mind pays for its deadening to the state of our world by giving up its capacity for joy and flexibility. So that's a lot of sort of the bad news, or maybe not news. I'm aware of myself having said the word suffering a lot already. But the promise is really this, that if we, you know, abstain from repressing our painful emotions, we allow ourselves to feel them. We allow ourselves to feel a lot of other things too, and we'll open up and see other possibilities that they weren't capable to see when we were deliberately blocking out part of our experience. And so Joanna's, one of her key phrases in her teachings is this, the great turning, this like shift away from an industrial growth society to a life-sustaining civilization. And so a fundamental part of this turning is spiritual. But it's about opening up to something greater, to ourselves, opening up from our illusion that we're separate selves. We talk about small mind as sort of the ego self in Zen, and then the big mind, which is really relating to and not separate from everything around us. As Joanna says, the heart that breaks right open can hold the whole universe. Another promise there. A little more bad news. Thich Nhat Hanh points out that whether we register it or not, the daily loss of species, habitats, and cultures are registered deep in our psyches. In other words, so much of the grief we carry is not personal, but it's collective. And goes on to say that we may not live in a war zone, but in the deepest levels of our consciousness, we receive the effects of the suffering of the people who live where there is war. In our conscious mind, we may never be aware of it, but our unconscious mind is aware of the suffering that's happening everywhere. Or as Martin Luther King so eloquently phrased it, "Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. We're caught in an inescapable network of mutuality, tied in a single garment of destiny. Whatever affects one directly affects all indirectly." So, there is, however, an upside, some upsides to this. And Thich Nhat Hanh as well tries to illustrate this, that and he's encouraging us to sort of to feel this pain and but not to think that it's like part of a mistake is we think it's mine, right? But it's we're actually feeling the suffering of the world in a way. But if we see our suffering as part of a greater consciousness, then it eases our own individual pain and our suffering can cease. I remember a time at Green Gulch, I'd been in a funk for a while. I don't know if it was a week or a few weeks or something, but just tense and, higher level of unsatisfactoriness and frustration than usual. And as I was sitting in morning zazen, and this like tight feeling, and it sort of wasn't making sense. And somewhere in there, it came to me like, it's like, maybe this isn't my suffering somehow. There was no like the stories that I had been creating of like why I was feeling the way I was weren't really holding up, and somehow it's like maybe this is this is dukkha, this is this kind of a form of distress. It wasn't specifically around the climate or something like that, but I just sort of had a sense of what I was feeling wasn't just mine. It was a universal human condition, and it really changed the experience. It just kind of the bubble popped right there. Wasn't skipping out of the zendo to breakfast afterwards, but it was just a sort of a lightness and a spaciousness around where I didn't sort of I was no longer identified with the way I was feeling, and it did sort of transform. And I think this is especially be the case if we reflect on our relationship to the world and our love for it, and how we suffer. It's like that pain isn't our small self suffering. It's really that pain that we're feeling, whether we're aware of it or not, whether we're even acknowledging climate change or not. We're feeling that, and if we can recognize that, it can change the sense of being stuck in it and incapacitated by it. So these teachers seem to suggest. So just as in Buddhism, there is not just the first noble truth, but the third noble truth, which builds upon the first. I think the climate change really challenges us to open up to something greater than ourselves. We need to cultivate this capacity again to feel both pain and joy, gratitude and compassion. We may, to reflect on the conversation last week, both experience what an extraordinarily beautiful day is and also feel the pain and love, like this weather is not normal for this time of year, for example. And also, once we begin to heal from really this trauma of separation from the earth, from the world around us, our change of what is possible, our sense of what's possible will begin to change accordingly. So, just wanted to close with the kind of mind-blowing example of what we human beings actually are capable of, and when kind of it pushes us, it's mind-blowing because it pushes us to really believe that we're not separate from one another. It's from an article I just came across in Waging Nonviolence by Charlie Wood, and it's titled, "What If the Climate Crisis is an Invitation to Deepen Our Spiritual Selves?" So the author says, "An incredible example of the power of compassion, this human capacity for compassion, is the research of psychologist Jean Achterberg." I'm not familiar with. In the study, indigenous Hawaiian healers were invited to choose a person with whom they held a compassionate bond. These people were placed in functional MRI scanners and isolated from all forms of sensory contact with the healer. The healers then enter scanners in a building away from the receivers and were invited to start sending healing intentions to their subjects at 2-minute intervals. The receivers had no way of discerning when these intentions were sent, yet 10 times out of 11, at the exact time the healer sent the intention, specific areas of the brain associated with receiving loving emotions were activated. This is one of many examples of the power of compassion and how it can influence people in places far away from us. Thank you very much.